and good evening, everyone, to a rather novel stream, as far as this channel's concerned, where I'm breaking down the claims made by Vladimir Putin during a recent interview, the 8th of February, 2024, where Tucker Carlson actually prefaced this. This was originally aired on X, formerly Twitter, where Tucker was quite baffled that Putin decided to start his interview by going on a very long oration about Russian-Ukrainian history. And I think this thumbnail is rather apt in terms of being able to demonstrate how stupefied and unprepared Tucker was in terms of being able to deal with this form of discussion, despite the fact that Putin was having fun with him the entire time, saying that, oh yes, well, you've studied history. Well, are you interested in having a serious conversation, or aren't you? Now, what prompted my investment in doing this, because I wasn't ever sort of imagining to do this sort of in a pre-prepared fashion, especially that we didn't expect this interview to happen. And then when it did happen, we didn't expect Putin to deliver a lengthy oration around history. Quite a few people on Twitter were quick to point out that Putin was doing an AM. He was going out of his way to give a copious amount of historical context in response to any given question. That's my superpower, but it seems that I finally have a kindred spirit here. But nevertheless, some historians came out and they attempted to debunk many of the claims made by Putin in this interview. The egregious example which really set me off was one by Tom Holland. He hosts a podcast, I believe, that's called The Rest is History. He is a Roman historian, which begs the question as to why he was so invested in taking down the claims of Vladimir Putin and Russian-Ukrainian history. One has to wonder. I hope it wasn't simply a matter of having to virtue signal to indicate his support for the policies directed in support of Ukraine, but nevertheless, his video had left a lot to be desired. He didn't really debunk anything. The claim he made about Poland, I will get into in far more depth than he went into. He was appealing to Vox Populi, Vox Dei. Common knowledge simply says that Putin was wrong. Well, I'm going to investigate Putin's claims in much more depth. And Tom Holland's argument, which is very Orwellian, is very much ignorance's strength. He decried the fact that Putin was invested in history, that he had a particular narrative in history, that he has a conception of nationhood that was vested in the entirety of history and not simply nations as conceived of and understood in 21st century language. That was the essence of his argument. To the extent that he believes that his history, Holland believes that Putin's history, has given him some sort of overarching mission or zealousness in terms of being able to wage war on Ukraine, is how he sees it. And of course, he then goes on to claim that Putin's worldview cannot counter any obstacles. Everything he believes has to be the way it was. It is a very rigid and uncompromising version of history. The irony, of course, is that the same argument can be applied to Tom Holland. But the argument against this then goes on because the BBC, lovingly, in pursuit of its mandate for objectivity, wrote an article called Tucker Carlson Interview, Fact-Checking Putin's Nonsense History. And this featured two supposedly prominent historians, one Sergei Radchenko at Johns Hopkins and Ronald Suny. And I will get into the specific claims made in this article as I go through the actual transcript of the interview. Needless to say, I wasn't very impressed. But before I get into the actual wording, and I'll be reading from the transcript. You can find it on the actual official Kremlin website. I want people to look at this map here, which is a path to Ukrainian and Russian statehood. Someone asked me on Twitter, essentially, how to look at some sort of overarching development. And the image on the left here is very much how I wanted to construe a iteration of Ukrainian history stemming from a lecture which was taken about 2 years ago, whereby we have an inception of a Rus culture that is then split. It goes through many parallel iterations that you see here, Vladimir, Kiev, Novgorod, Halych, Muscovy, Ruthenia, unites back into the Tsardom of all the Russias, and then it splits off again to become Ukraine and Russia, and then amalgamated as part of the Soviet Union, but very much cognizant that these two nations now exist. Now, Putin's view seems to be further detached from that in terms of, you can say, the most Russophile argument, which simply sees Ukraine, Russia, Rus as one straight line. They are one the same civilization. They are one the same state. Putin's views are more nuanced than that. Nevertheless, I wouldn't necessarily say that he adheres to my view, but more or less you can say a middle ground between the straight line and the curve I've indicated here. And then, of course, just for the sake of being able to understand this, on the right, we have the Ukrainian arguments. One is, of course, the parallel conception of Ukraine and Russia as having always existed side by side as part of the same Rus civilization. And then I would say there was the anti-Russian Ukraine supremacist argument here, which says that Ukraine are the Rus, they are the Russian civilization, and Muscovy was a contrivance by the Golden Horde, which itself was a ulus or segment of the Mongol Empire. So in many ways, Muscovy is an other, and Russia in itself is a is an aberration. It doesn't exist. It's a misnomer. But nevertheless, I'm not going to be going to these claims. I'm going to be investing Putin's claims and pitting them against my own understanding of Ukraine and in reference to these other historians. So let's get into the meat and actually go through the transcript. So Tucker begins the conversation, and then, rather surprisingly, Putin goes into his lengthy oration around history, and here it is. Let's look where our relationship with Ukraine started from. Where does Ukraine come from? The Russian state started to exist as a centralized state in 862. This is considered to be the year of creation of the Russian state, because this year the townspeople of Novgorod invited Rurik, a Varangian prince from Scandinavia, to reign. In 862, Russia celebrated the 1000th anniversary of its statehood, and in Novgorod, there is a memorial dedicated to the 1000th anniversary of the country. Now, there are issues with that, but I'm not going to do what the BBC did here. This is the quote by Sergei Radchenko. Vladimir Putin is trying to construct a narrative backwards, saying Russia as a state began its development in the 9th century. You could equally say that Ukraine as a state began its development in the 9th century, exactly with the same kind of evidence and documents. And I want to inform Sergei Radchenko, if he ever watches this video, that if you were to use evidence and documents of the 9th century, the word Ukraine does not exist at this time. It doesn't really appear in documents until, I think, the early attestation is the 12th century. So you cannot make that claim, and the BBC shouldn't have publicized this, but again, me expecting competency and a sense of verisimilitude at the BBC is obviously, you know, far beyond the pale of what I can expect. But nevertheless, there are issues that are brought up here. And this goes into what was Putin's purpose in delivering this history lecture at the beginning of his interview on Ukraine? Because Putin is obviously trying to present his argument in the most favorable terms. He's trying to convince, he's trying to appeal to, you can say, more literate Westerners through a sense of the grand arc of history. And as a result of this, there are many, you can say, there is a necessity in order to create a convincing narrative, yet at the same time, Putin makes strategic omissions and conflates many ideas as well in order, you can say, to paint the most coherent, concise, and you can say oversimplified narrative, to the point that at various times it can come across as disingenuous. And this is the first point I want to get into, completely throwing Radchenko's ridiculous argument into the rubbish bin, which is the Russian state started to exist as a centralized state in 862. Now, what is a centralized state? I would never claim that Russia began as a centralized state in 862, and this has many issues. What Putin is doing is conflating Rus with Russian. etymologically, they are essentially the same. And this is something that I talked about in my own lecture, which is the idea of Russia, the land of the Rus, the land of, essentially, and many iterations of the Rus coming mean the White Rus, the Belarusians, the Blue Russians, the Red Russians, the cardinal directions inherited from steppe peoples and the Mongols. But nevertheless, this idea that a Russian state, whereby we can conflate it with the modern Russian state as having existed in 862, that is a leap if ever I saw one. You can say that there is a Russian entity, a Rus entity, that comes into existence in 862, the same time that we have the arrival of Uruk. That in itself is still a contentious date. There are some people who believe that the Rus came down and attacked the city of Constantinople in the year 860, which would mean that the Rus had to have arrived, or the Rurikids had to arrive and establish the state before then. But that isn't so much the issue I have with Putin. In that sense, Putin is very conservative in terms of this official date of 862. But there are other implications of this. So one of all, you can't claim it's the beginning of a centralized state, let alone a Russian state. You have to see this as the beginning of a Rus-Russian civilization, a cultural entity, but not a centralized state. Because what we mean by a state is an authority exerting power over a territory. The whole notion of that is thrown up in the air, and there are so many states, Rus-Russian states existing, and Muscovy is one state, Kiev and the various examples I'm going to bring up are others. A centralized state makes it even more contentious because it implies that there was a formal state, a formal sense of statehood. And another parallel you can say bringing here, why the year 862 centralized state, you can bring up, say, for example, Athelstan, 927. As the beginning of an English state, or 987, when Hugh Capet was elected king of France, West Francia, then France, as the beginning of a French state. But those two examples I brought up, Athelstan and Hugh Capet, are considerably more convincing in terms of being able to indicate a continuity of statehood, because France would go on to establish a territory over what was formerly West Francia, more or less, and England again would occupy roughly the same territory, with minor exceptions in Wales and Scotland, up until the present day. The same cannot be said at all for whatever iteration of the Rus existed here. And so again, Putin is trying to establish the origins of the Russian state with such sort of convincing certitude as one can compare it to other European countries. In terms of bringing this forward to his other points, he actually goes on to contradict himself. I do wonder again if many other historians have been a little more perspicacious, and they weren't so willing just simply to deride this for the sake of virtue signaling, that may have actually focused on these various points. But yet again, I'm still looking at Russian and Ukrainian statehood as Putin would, within the grand arc of the last millennia, as opposed to trying to conceive all of this in 21st century terms. But there is another very interesting point that is implicit here, before I move on to everything else, which is he talks about Rurik, a Varangian prince from Scandinavia. And then he talks about the townspeople of Novgorod. The townspeople of Novgorod aren't given an ethnicity. Rurik is a Varangian prince from Scandinavia, or probably more likely Sweden. So from the outset, Putin's conception of Russia and Ukraine is not based on ethnicity. And this is something I want to refer to back at the end of this discussion, because for reference, I'm not going to be able to go through the entire interview. I'm going to be focusing on parts of the interview which I believe are historically pertinent, without focusing on the immediate run-up to Ukraine, the economic arguments that Putin brings, the strategic arguments, the arguments around the coup in 2014. My focus is very much going to be up until the year 1945, with the creation of the modern Ukraine state borders under the USSR. So several things to bring up. Centralized state as being a very dubious term, the conflation with Rus and Russia, the idea that Putin isn't ascribing a ethnicity yet to this quote-unquote centralized Russian state. So moving on. In 882, Rurik's successor, Prince Oleg, who was actually playing the role of regent at Rurik's young son, because Rurik had died at the time, came to Kiev. He ousted two brothers who apparently had once been members of Rurik's squad. So Russia began to develop with two centers of power, Kiev and Novgorod. And again, that in itself actually contradicts the centralized state claim. Because how can there be a centralized state and there also be two centers of power, Kiev and Novgorod? You are setting the stage for two roughly equivalent principalities, one in the north near the Baltic and one in the south near the Black Sea. So obviously that wasn't proof read in terms of Putin being able to regurgitate this. That is a contradiction. But it also plays into this argument that I have here, which is the origins of the split actually occur with Kiev and Novgorod and the supremacy of the city-states over the idea of a Rus civilization. Nevertheless, he doesn't talk about Kiev with any sort of preeminence over Novgorod. Rather, he creates parity between the two. And establishing parity would in itself add legitimacy further to the Muscovite state, which was in itself a descendant of Novgorod. So back to Putin. The next very significant date in the history of Russia was 988. This was the baptism of Russia, when Prince Vladimir, the great grandson of Rurik, baptized Russia and adopted Orthodoxy or Eastern Christianity. From this time, the centralized Russian state began to strengthen. Why? Because of a single territory, integrated economic ties, one and the same language, and after the baptism of Russia, the same faith and rule of the prince. The centralized Russian state began to take shape. Well, before then, the Russians were pagan. Vladimir the Great had himself been experimenting with various religious concoctions. The story is that he sent messengers out to all the Christian centers in the world. He went to Constantinople, or rather his emissaries went to Constantinople, and was so overwhelmed that it was essentially a matter of Byzantine soft power influencing the Byzantification, the conversion of the Russian ruler to Orthodoxy, even though that is really apocryphal. There were far more sort of earthly incentives, economic and marriage. And there was also a marriage link also with the Varangian princes and the Byzantine royal family. So many other reasons as to why Russia would gravitate towards Orthodoxy. But again, the picture that Putin is claiming is right in the sense that this represents some form of national origin. We start off with the two power centers of Novgorod and Kiev, which are not centralized states, but as he says, power centers, two fort cities which are dominating various rivers. With Kiev, it's especially the Dnieper. And the Russians are able to exert power having arrived from Scandinavia. They're great seafarers. In fact, it is the Russian mastery of the sea which allows them to gain one up on the Kuman Kipchaks when they go across the Volga. And I believe actually before they destroy the Khazar Khanate. Interesting things, but relating this back to Putin and what he's saying, the idea of a single territory, integrated economic ties, one language, and after the baptism of Russia, the same faith and rule of the prince. Well, Vladimir the Great essentially held the north in tandem. It wasn't a centralized state. The princes of Novgorod weren't always the Grand Princes of Kiev, which was the preeminent city of the Rus at this time. So again, he emphasizes the term again, he said this three times, which is a centralized Russian state. And again, that's not true. If you compare Russia to France, France again was massively decentralized. The kings of France at that time held little authority out of the Île-de-France. I think it's fair to say that Russia bears far more similarity to France of that time than it does to anything resembling that of a centralized state. I would even say the notion of a centralized state having existed in the end at the end of the 10th century was really rather ludicrous anywhere in the world, even as far as China or the Byzantine Empire. But again, Putin is clearly doing this. There is a kernel of truth here, which is the genesis of a Rus-Russian nation. And I'm intentionally conflating these words, but if it is if to indicate that there is a continuity in the culture and the civilization, and you can say these historical and dynastic and territorial links, but there is not a specific continuity when it comes to statehood. Nevertheless, that is not enough simply to declare that Russia and Muscovy are synonymous. No, it's a far more nuanced argument than that. But Putin is going to the other extreme of conflating them. But nevertheless, Putin has a general conception that Russia begins as a state with the baptism of Vladimir the Great. Back in the Middle Ages, Prince Yaroslav the Wise introduced the order of succession to the throne, but after he passed away, it became complicated for various reasons. The throne was passed not directly from father to eldest son, but from prince who had passed away to his brother, then his sons in different lines. All this led to the fragmentation and the end of the Rus as a single state. There was nothing special about it. The same was happening then in Europe, but the fragmented Russian state became easy prey to the empire created earlier by Genghis Khan. Now, I'm going to bring up this map here, especially the map on the left. Putin, again, has repeatedly referenced this idea that Russia was a centralized state, and I keep hearkening onto it because it simply isn't true. Prince Yaroslav the Wise introduced the order of succession, having reunited the throne after the Russian state, quote-unquote, the Russian principality, had disintegrated into 12 principalities, and you can see the principalities here. What Yaroslav does is not create a centralized state or reunify a centralized state, but he confirms a process of decentralization, and you can say a system of successive anarchy, whereby there is a rota system, whereby all the princes of Russia successfully elevate themselves from higher-ranking principalities until they arrive at the Grand Principality of Kiev, which indicates supremacy over all of the princes of the Rus. Now, this was an incredibly flawed system. It didn't last decades. It only lasted a few decades after Yaroslav the Wise's death. And the preeminence of Kiev was actually lost in this time. It was taken over by Vladimir Suzdal. This is actually a major point in my lecture regarding the inception of Ukraine, because I'm talking about the early loss of preeminence of the city of Ukraine within the rubric of a decentralized civilization, which is that of the myriad collection of the Rus principalities you see here, and moving it over to Vladimir Suzdal, because Vladimir Suzdal becomes the area which would later become the genesis of Muscovy as a Russian principality. Muscovy really is the heir to Vladimir Suzdal, as it is the heir of Alexander Nevsky and Novgorod. So one has to wonder why Putin didn't draw attention to this, as if to establish a legitimacy for Moscow when in terms of arriving at this great split. But here we are. Right. And again, all this led to the fragmentation and the end of a Rus as a single state. Like I said, there wasn't a single state. The state was already fractured. It was simply a matter of being able to manage the fractured and decentralized nature of what could approximate a Russian state or Rus state. There was nothing special about it. The same was happening then in Europe. By the same as happening there in Europe, I suppose you can draw a link to what is happening in Germany, which is during the 12th and 13th century, the 13th century primarily, Germany undergoes a process of rapid decentralization during a phase called the interregnum. And the result, kind of like what we see in Russia, is the creation of an elective monarchy and the formalization of decentralization. So in a sense there, he's true. And then he goes on, again, correctly to say, the fragmented Russian state, I would say the fragmented Russian civilization, not state, became an easy prey to the empires created earlier by Genghis Khan. His successors, namely Batu Khan, came to the Rus, plundered and ruined nearly all the cities, the southern part, including Kiev, by the way, and some other cities simply lost independence, while northern cities preserved some of their sovereignty. They had to pay tribute to the horde, but they managed to preserve some part of their sovereignty. And then a unified Russian state began to take shape with its center in Moscow. Now, this is obviously conflating all of this, because he's said the beginning of a unified Russian state many times. A unified Russian state began in 862. A unified Russian state began in 988. A unified Russian state began to take shape in its center in Moscow. Now, it should be mentioned here that I'm actually using the official Kremlin transcript here. This is what the Kremlin has translated and wants us to read. Yet at the same time, I can't help but feel that if there is a subtlety or a distinction to be applied, it is with that description of a unified Russian state, because there cannot be three moments of which a unified Russian state began to emerge, and this time with its center in Moscow. Because at the one time, Putin is emphasizing continuity with the culture, preservation of a consistent statehood, and yet there are many times where the state comes into existence. And this is why I don't slip up in terms of my own argumentation to say that Muscovy is simply one of these power centers, as you can see on the image on the left, as part of this fragmented whole. And by happenstance and luck, given the situation with the conquest of the Mongols in the 13th century, Muscovy is able to establish themselves as the primus inter pares, the largest and most valuable principality under the yoke of the Mongols. One of the early princes of Moscow, Prince Ivan, was even known as Moneybags for his role in collecting tribute from all of the other princes. And they would compete for the title of Grand Prince of Vladimir. The Grand Prince of Vladimir, harkening back to the pre-Mongol situation as representing preeminence over all the Rus'. Not preeminence or beholden to a state, but simply preeminence of all of these groups, these principalities, these bandits, these city-states. And bringing up the article from the BBC, Ronald Sunni declares that the Rus' was made up of a bunch of bandits who burned their own capital repeatedly. Now, again, there is an element of truth in that, and I brought that up with the fact that Kiev was sacked before the Mongols arrived, and the preeminence of Kiev was overtaken by that of the city of Vladimir Suzdal. So there is an element to that which is true, but that doesn't make up for the other errors in the BBC article. But nevertheless, continuing on. The southern part of the Russian lands, including Kiev, began to gradually gravitate towards another magnet, the center that was emerging in Europe. This was the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. It was even called the Lithuanian-Russian Duchy, because Russians were a significant part of its population. Again, Lithuanian-Russian Duchy. There are various appellations to Lithuania-Ruthenia, but it wasn't a formal appellation. Ruthenia as being a major component of Lithuania. Ruthenia is a Latinized concept of what it means to be Russian. And what I believe you can say to be the early sort of prospective state, which any sort of Ukrainian nationality can hold to, is the idea of this small state. You can see on the image on the left here, there are principalities around Volyn and around Halych. Halych formed the basis of what was briefly called the Kingdom of Russia. It was a Catholic kingdom, which with claims essentially to fight back the Mongol yoke. It was destroyed, and it was later replaced by the Kingdom of Galicia and Volhynia, which existed until the 14th century before being taken over by the Poles and by the Lithuanians. But that in itself represented, you can say, a form of alternative Russian or Rus' rule compared to the state of Muscovy, which is emerging around the same time. However, this state, Ruthenian state, gets gobbled up by the Polish and the Lithuanians. But again, using the term Lithuanian-Russian duchy seems a bit dishonest, not in terms of the conflation between a idea of permanent Russian statehood as applying to all these territories using this modern word, but also the idea that, that the Lithuanians wouldn't have conceived of it as such. They would concede of their subjects as Ruthenian. And as for these Ruthenians, they spoke the old Russian language and were Orthodox. And old Russian language, in terms of having a script, in terms of having a unified tongue, I will say that the Slavs have remarkable unity when it comes to the confluence between all of the language groups, the West Slavs, the East Slavs, and the Southern Slavs. One of my sort of favorite etymologies for Slav is Slovo, which means those who speak. So in this sense, you can say, yes, there was probably remarkable linguistic unity, especially considering the fragmented nature of polities existing in the medieval world. Nevertheless, it is clear that there was a divergence which was beginning to emerge around the 14th and the 15th centuries. There was a unification, and going back to Putin, the union of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and the Kingdom of Poland. A few years later, another union was signed, but this time already in the religious sphere, some of the Orthodox priests became subordinate to the Pope. Thus, these lands became part of the Polish-Lithuanian state. During decades, the Poles were engaged in the Polonization of this part of the population. They introduced their language there, tried to entrench the idea that the populations were not exactly Russians, that because they lived on the fringe, Ukraya, they were Ukrainians. Originally, the word Ukrainian meant a person that was living on the outskirts of the state, near the fringe, or was engaged in border service. It didn't mean any particular ethnic group. Now, this, again, going back to the article, if I can find, effectively, the idea is that the term Ukraine comes from Poland. It is a process of othering the Rus people, or what Putin is repeatedly conflating as the Russian people, as becoming Polonized, as becoming Westernized, as becoming Catholic, as having their priests being subordinate to the Pope. Now, what the nuance which he's missing here is that there is a religious division going on within the Orthodox world. There is the religion in Muscovy, which is becoming far more independent from the base of Eastern Orthodoxy, which is in Greece. The patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church in Constantinople is currently under the occupation of the Ottoman Turks, who are Muslims. And as a consequence of that, Muscovy is going its own way in terms of being able to assert its own religious independence vis-a-vis the Greeks. However, the Muscovites are not in control of the vast Orthodox Ruthenian population, which is now under the rule of the Lithuanians and the Polish. So what does this mean? This means that the Poles, rather cleverly, take this as their cue to exploit the divisions between Eastern Orthodoxy to establish the union of the churches, the Uniate Church, whereby many Orthodox priests willingly go over and enter into communion with the Pope in Rome. It wasn't necessarily a matter of subjugation, as if this they were simply imposed, but nevertheless, there was a sense after the union that there was a feeling of betrayal, that they had been duped into this union. Nevertheless, it should be noted that if this was simply a matter of subjugation, how would that explain the fact that the Uniate Church, the Catholic church with the Slavonic liturgy, which is the basis of this, still exists today? And again, Putin goes on to this idea of Polonization and the origins of Ukraine. This is not the origin of Ukraine. The origin of the word Ukraine comes from around the 12th century, and it is not simply in reference to the fact that the Poles had border people, but the fact that the entire Russian collection of principalities had border people, Ukrainians. Ukrania effectively would render it as similar to the German word of the mark being some form of frontier state or settlement. There is a specific connotation when it comes to the origins of the word Ukrainia, which is around the region of Pereyaslav in the south. And the reason this territory in particular became designated or colloquially understood to be the first Ukrainia was because it was faced off against the Khazars, and then the Kuman Kipchaks, the Pechenegs, all of these nomadic confederations which were inhabiting the Pontic steppe. And later, of course, they would become dominated by the Golden Horde, which in turn would come to dominate the entirety of the Eastern Rus, or Muscovy, Novgorod, as tributaries. So this is the origin of Ukrainian. But so Putin is taking liberties in terms of saying that the origin of the word originated from a process of Polonization. That in itself, again, strategically, is very useful for Putin to utilize, because it effectively means that the idea of Ukrainian nationality was implanted from a foreign power, which is a consistent theme that Putin's trying to use, which is the idea of a centralized Russian state. A large sector of that Russian state are now under the control of a different state, and that other state are attempting to inject ideas of separatism, coming up with this idea on the one hand of Polonization of the population and the designation of a population which aren't exactly Russians, which are Ukrainians. Now, how is Putin actually correct here in terms of not designating any particular ethnic group? And again, saying that the Ukrainians don't represent a particular ethnic group is correct in a sense, but it also means that Putin is also denying the early Ukrainians an ethnogenesis. And this will be consistent with his own conception of how Russia identifies as not being an ethno state. But when it comes to understanding the Ukrainians and what he really means here, you can say that this term less applies the idea of Ukrainians, because like I say, that term is more of a geographic descriptor as opposed to a popular descriptor, i.e. there are Ukraines, there are marks, there are nomadic areas. In the case of Poland in the 17th century, the mark, or the Ukraine, was facing against the Tatars in Crimea, which were under the control of the Ottomans, and launched massive slave raids into Polish Ruthenia. We're talking tens of thousands of people every year being taken by the Tatars and sold off in the markets in Constantinople. But what Putin's doing here, weirdly, is actually conflating Ukrainian with Cossacks. Cossacks were border people. They occupied the Zaporizhia, or the wild fields, and they themselves didn't have a particular ethnic group. They began to coalesce around a certain identity based on this frontier culture, facing off from the Poles and their attempts at centralization on the one hand, and the Tatar Muslim slave raids on the other. So what Putin is doing is deliberately conflating all of these ideas to indicate that Ukraine as an idea was essentially imposed from a sense of otherness created through the project of polonization. So again, that may sound very complicated, but I believe that there is definitely a tactical impetus as to why Putin's doing this. Again, Putin's not stupid. This is incredibly subtle, and a lot of people who should know better are obviously missing out on these subtleties. But if we're going to criticize Putin, there is a way to go about it, and it's not simply by saying everything he is saying is nonsense. There is a kernel of truth in what he's doing here, but the narrative is presented in such a way as to talk about this process of continual Russian statehood and then a process of conquest and alienation, which can in itself be described as the origin of Ukrainian statehood. But even then, I would disagree with the idea of the use of Ukrainians, because again, Ukraine, a geographic descriptor meaning the mark, and Ruthenian meaning Russians operating within a Latin dominated culture, a Latin Catholic dominated culture, meaning Lithuania and Poland. So continuing on. So the Poles were trying in every possible way to polonize this part of the Russian lands and actually treated it rather harshly, not to say cruelly. All that led to the fact that this part of the Russian lands began to struggle for their rights. They wrote letters to Warsaw demanding that their rights be observed and that peoples be commissioned here, including in Kiev. Now, what Putin is getting at is the fact that there are many local magnates, many of them from Poland and Lithuania, who are building up great estates in the vast, underpopulated, but nevertheless fertile plains on the right bank of the Ukraine. And there was also a process of trying to convert the Orthodox population into Catholicism, either Catholicism of the Latin liturgy or of the Slavonic variety. But nevertheless, there were local leaders, and there were very eminent Cossacks, one of whom was Hmelnytsky, which is what Putin is ultimately getting to. So at this point, Tucker Carlson interjects and says, I beg your pardon, can you tell us what period? I'm losing track of where we are in history. I mean, in fairness to Tucker Carlson, I don't think anyone could have really expected or being able to deal with these points as they come, unless I was interviewing Vladimir Putin, but obviously for various reasons that would never happen. So Vladimir Putin now comes back. Now I will tell you what happened later and give the date so there is no confusion. In 1654, even a bit earlier, the people who are in control of the authority over the part of the Russian lands address Warsaw. What he's really meaning are the Cossacks, the Sitradas, the confederations around these fortresses on the border, or the Ukran, addressed to Warsaw, I repeat, demanding their rights be observed, that they send that to them rulers of Russian origin and Orthodox faith. Again, Russian origin is incredibly dubious. By Russian origin, he's explicitly sort of indicating the fact that we're not talking about Poles and we're not talking about Lithuanians. Again, the conflation between Rus, Ruthenian, and Russian is very obvious here, and it's clear why he's doing it. But the Orthodox faith, Putin doesn't seem to believe that the Uniate can be considered Orthodox. And that is the argument which is being presented here, which is the Cossacks do not want a Uniate variety or a Catholic variety of the Orthodox faith. They want one which is either loyal to the Patriarch in Constantinople, most likely, rather than one who is loyal to the Patriarch in Moscow. When Warsaw, i.e. the capital of Poland, did not answer them, and in fact they rejected their demands, they turned to Moscow, and so that Moscow took them away. So that you don't think I'm inventing things, I'll give you these documents. It doesn't sound like you're inventing it, but I'm not sure why it's relevant because it happened to what happened 2 years ago. Putin replies, but still, these documents are from the archives, copies. Here are letters from Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the man who then controlled the power in this part of the Russian lands in what is now called Ukraine. Again, I would call Khmelnytsky a Cossack leader over, you can say, this authority you actually establish here on the right, which is, you can say, the borders of the left bank Ukraine, or the principality of the left bank Ukraine, which has its own Hetman, which is a variety, a Slavicized variety of the word Hauptmann, which effectively means captain. But the Cossack identity is very much baked into what we can be considered to be the origins of any sort of genesis of a Ukrainian people here. But interestingly enough, Putin is not using the word Cossack, and I have to wonder why. Because if anything, the use of the word Cossack would actually aid his point in terms of being able to diminish a state of constant continuity regarding that of a Ukrainian nation. But what he's referring to, I'll continue reading here because he's going to go into more detail. Khmelnytsky wrote to Warsaw demanding that their rights be upheld, and after being refused, he began to write letters to Moscow. Russia would not agree to submit to them straight away, assuming this would trigger a war with Poland. Nevertheless, in 1654, the Zemsky Sobor, which was a representative body of power in the old Russian state, made the decision. Those old Russian lands became part of the Tsardom of Muscovy. As expected, the war with Poland began. It lasted 13 years, and then the truce was concluded. In all, after that act of 1654, 32 years after, I think, at peace, treaty with Poland was concluded, the eternal peace, as it said, and those lands, the whole left bank of the Dnieper, including Kiev, reverted to Russia, while the entire right bank of the Dnieper remained in the possession of Poland. Now, there's a lot to get into here. Now, Putin is referring to this as the return of the Kiev and the left bank to Russia, the reverting back to Russia. Now, that in itself, again, is not quite true, because there are two claims being made here. One is that this quote-unquote Treaty of Pereyaslav, again, interestingly, Ukraina as originating in Pereyaslav 500 years earlier. Now we see the Treaty of Pereyaslav. The Treaty of Pereyaslav is used, on the one hand, to represent the reunion of the quote-unquote Ruthenian peoples of the left bank and Ukraine into a Russian state. And it is from this moment that the Tsar at the time, the Tsar Alexis, changes the style of the Tsar to Tsar of all the Russias, as in to indicate the union of all these Russian peoples. However, the complementary article to that is that this isn't simply a matter of restoration. It is also simply a matter of nascent national genesis, which is the idea that this is the beginning of a distinct statehood, distinct from that of Russia, that this isn't a reverting back to the Russian state, but this is a new state forming an alliance under the protection of Russia. Hence why some Ukrainophiles use the term, or the Treaty of Pereyaslav and the date of 1654 as to indicate the origin of Ukrainian statehood, even though that's a backwards appellation for reasons that I will explain. And this idea is the justification for why Khrushchev, 300 years later in 1954, would hand the territory of Crimea to the Soviet Socialist Republic of Ukraine out of a gesture of goodwill for the quote-unquote original Treaty of Pereyaslav, which at the same time supposedly created the basis of a Ukrainian state and entered into the fraternal association between Ukraine and that of Greater Russia. So there are many arguments you can present as to what Khmelnytsky was effectively doing. Was it a reunion or was it independence? Fundamentally, I view it as protection. I see it as the Cossacks essentially wanting to defect from a Catholic Polish overlord to a Russian overlord, who would fundamentally protect them from the encroachments of the Tatars. Especially, we're talking at a time where Poland is becoming very weak, and the Russians can pose as a much stronger threat to the Ottomans and the Tatars, the perennial problem for the so-called Ukraina. So it makes every logical reason for mutual advantage as to why the Cossacks in that region would ally to Russia. But referring this back to Kiev reverting to what had already existed as a centralized Russian state is again, it's not conflation, it's disingenuous. There is nuance here, but obviously Putin has to spin it in a certain way. But again, there is enough truth here where Putin can present this argument with all this information. And again, this is the point where Putin hands Tucker Carlson the documents, but then Tucker Carlson doesn't go over the documents and be able to evaluate all the nuances. Not that it would be any help, because I doubt that Tucker Carlson can either read the old iterations of the Ukrainian dialect or old Russian, but there we are. The point was made, if anything, in the interview intentionally to buttress these claims about a process of reunion as opposed to protectorship. Anyway, going on. Under the rule of Catherine the Great, Russia reclaimed all of its historical lands, including the south and west. This all lasted until the revolution, before World War I. Austrian general staff relied on the ideas of Ukrainization and started actively promoting the ideas of Ukraine and Ukrainianization. Their motive was obvious. Just before World War I, they wanted to weaken the potential enemy and secure themselves favorable conditions in the border area. So the idea which had emerged in Poland that people residing in the territory were allegedly not really Russians, but rather belonged to a special ethnic group, Ukrainians, started being propagated by the Austrian general staff. Okay, there's a lot to unpack here. Under the rule of Catherine the Great, Russia reclaimed all of its historical lands, including the south and west. So this is obviously in reference to the partitions of Poland. And again, in terms of a process of reclamation, this wasn't justification that Catherine the Great herself used to justify the divvying up of such a large segment of Poland, Lithuania to become amalgamated with Russia. What we're talking about here is more or less the entire territories of modern Belarus and Ukraine, with the major exception of Galicia, which was part of the Austrian Empire. So in this sense, Putin is repeating the claim made by Catherine the Great. And again, this talks about, you can say, the indivisibility of a single Russian territory that you can see on the image on the left here, that this state has already always existed. And what we see 1,000 years later is the restoration of that ancient patronage, and not even the entire restoration, because Tsar Nicholas II during World War I will come to the occupied region of Galicia and say that this region has always been Russian. So on the one hand, you can say that there is a claim, there is a medieval pretext, but in Putin's mind, there is a centralized state that has always existed, and these territories represent a restoration. They haven't been able to foster any identity of their own up until this point, let alone the fact that many of the population are now Catholic, they are now Poles, they are now Lithuanians, and many of them indeed are Jews, something that wasn't really a factor in terms of looking at the ethnic composition of the old Muscovite state before its rapid expansion at the expense of Poland, Lithuania. So that's one thing to consider. This all lasted until the revolution. Before World War I, Austrian general staff relied on the ideas of Ukrainianization. So what he's doing when talking about the Austrian general staff, again, as with the process of Polonization, creating the idea of Ukraine as distinct from that of the Russians, which he is conflating with Ruthenians, what he's doing here when it comes to the idea of the Austrian general staff propagating this idea to weaken a potential enemy, i.e. directing that towards Russia, is again implanting this notion of a siege mentality, that there is a hostile Western conception to propagate this anti-Russian identity to divvy up and divide the Rus peoples. Now, the way that he is presenting it here, Putin is presenting that, he's presenting it as a military conspiracy, when in reality, the Austrians were reacting to a situation that was to their advantage. Correct me, because I'm doing this off the cuff. I'm simply responding. I don't have a prepared lecture. This was all very sort of last minute. So if I do make errors, do hold me up and mention it in the chat. But in the 1870s, Alexander II proclaimed something called the Ems Ukaz, Ems being a spa town in what is now Czechia, wherein he suppressed the publication of manuscripts in the Ukrainian dialect. As a result of that, many Ruthenian intellectuals, or Little Russian, Malorussian intellectuals, Little Russia being another appellation, with the White Russians, Belorussia, and the Great Russians, which are the Russians themselves. The term Little Russian would have been endemic during that time, and the term Ukrainian wasn't really going to become popularized for another few decades as of yet. But in the 1870s, there was a mass exodus of Little Russian intellectuals from Kiev, and in particular the West, that then emigrated to the Austrian Empire. The Austrian Empire, which in its present a province of Galicia, had a large Ruthenian population, which was more or less dominated by the Poles. It is here, in what is now the city of Lviv, but what was previously the old city of Lemberg, that an idea of Ukraine is being popularized, taking the idea of Ukrania, or the Ukraine, is to render in English, and people are going to say, oh, you know, there are no prepositions. Yes, I know. I'm referring to the etymologies of Ukrania and Ukrania. They sound very similar. There is in the Latin transcript, again, because I don't use the Cyrillic, there is an O there. But to distinguish here, one means province or borderland, and one means nation. The inception of Ukraine as an idea is used effectively to justify the separateness of what was then Malorussia, Little Russia, from the rest of the Russian Empire, which had amalgamated all these territories together under Catherine the Great. Now, the Austrians look at this and see that this is actually a brilliant opportunity, because up until that point, many of the quote-unquote Ruthenians or Little Russians living in the Austrian Empire looked to Russia for protection. But now, seeing the intellectual sort of development happening in Lemberg, Lviv, the Austrians are seeing that there is a potential identity which can be used to bring the Ruthenian population away from alliance with the Russians and towards allegiance with the Austrians. This was an idea being propped up by the Belvedere Circle, among other groups. I mean, if one looks to Franz Ferdinand, who was the heir of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before he was assassinated in Sarajevo in 1914, the idea was very much in terms of being able to rejig the Austro-Hungarian Empire to represent all of these new ethnicities, all of these defined ethnicities. And Ukraine could have been one of those ethnicities. But also, if you establish a nucleus of a Ukrainian nation in Galicia, then you can expand east and project a claim over all of the Little Russian speakers using the what was then retroactively referred to as the Ukrainian dialect. So all of these things were taken upon by the Austrian general staff and said, it makes complete strategic sense to go along with the idea of Ukrainianization, which is taking place within our borders. So what Putin is doing is taking that intellectual background, you can say rather justifiably, for all these intellectuals who feel that they've been forced to emigrate from Russia in the 1870s and 80s. And Putin is rephrasing this as a military conspiracy, which may be fair given his background in the KGB and then the FSB before he became president of Russia. And the fact that when Putin was actually talking about the centers of power with Tucker Carlson, he constantly brought up the intelligence agencies. He constantly brought up the CIA and whatever relation Tucker Carlson would have to the CIA. So you can say that this is, again, a fundamental point of Putin's own worldview, that he's very much informed by this idea of secret societies and secret police organizations who are fomenting these various plans or conspiracies in order to subvert foreign powers. And it's through this lens that Putin is conceiving of the origin of Ukrainianization in Galicia as an Austrian pet project. As far back as the 19th century, so this is going back to Putin again, as far back as the 19th century, theorists calling for Ukrainian independence appeared. All those, however, claimed that Ukraine should have a very good relationship with Russia. That is not true. And he's saying again, they insisted on that. Theorists calling for Ukrainian independence appeared. No. Those calling for Ukrainian independence specifically tended to be hostile to the Russian Empire. what I think Putin again is doing is conflating a vast array of groups, which are these little societies, if I recall correctly, called the Horodnas, and the Pan-Slavs, and the Nanodniks, the Friends of the People, these agrarian societies. All of these little organizations, you can say in many ways, they fetishized Cossacks. They fetishized the sort of nomadic free lifestyle on the steppe. And they looked to Ukraine as some form of democratic alternative to the Russian Empire, to the Tsar. Pan-Slavism, you can say, was a democratic revolt against the control of the Tsar, which is why the Tsar needed to tread very carefully around the topic of ethno-nationalism, as Putin's doing here. In terms of looking at these groups, these sort of agrarian groups and these sort of pro-Cossack groups, you can look at them and say that they are wanting to belong to a pan-Slavic identity, not necessarily a Russian empire. And so in that sense, they covet a very good relationship with Russia because they see Russia as part of the pan-Slavic brotherhood. However, they have a radically different conception of what a pan-Slavic state would be, as opposed to a Tsardom of Russia. So what Putin's doing here is perhaps, again, I can only infer based on what he said here, is taking that intellectual development, which is very distinct from the Ukrainophiles later on, and saying that they are essentially the same with Ukraine, as in to indicate that the natural impulse of these people is always to positive relationships to the Russians, and that the hostile relationship is being cultivated by an opposing force, either Poland, Lithuania, or the Austrian General Staff. So again, this isn't specifically true. And what it does is it denies the process of sort of Ukrainian statehood, the desire to create a Ukrainian state in the end of the 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, as something which was thought up somewhere else, and it wasn't the product of who would later become the Ukrainians themselves. So again, there is an aspect to which he is true, but he's conflating so much almost intentionally as if to appear disingenuous, and again, by design. After the 1970 revolution, the Bolsheviks sought to restore the statehood, and the civil war began, including the hostilities with Poland. I don't really understand what he means by restore the statehood, so I just have to move beyond that. In 1921, peace with Poland was proclaimed. Okay, I think I understand what he means. By restore the statehood, I think he means restore the territorial integrity, i.e. go off and try and unify the provinces of the Russian Empire. Again, that's a very weird way of looking at what the Bolsheviks did. The Bolsheviks didn't go about and try to restore the legal borders of the Russian Empire. That was an afterthought. The Bolsheviks wanted to take over everywhere as part of the workers' revolution. But yes, you can say that there was a sort of legal impetus in terms of the Soviet Union inheriting the territory of the old Russian Republic and then the Russian Empire that preceded it in 1917, and saying these are the legal boundaries, we are the government of these territories, thereby, you know, fuck off all of your independence movement and your attempts to invade, your Siberian interventions, etc. And then again, he brings this back to including hostilities with Poland, the specific emphasis on Poland. Blue-eyed summary, how to fall asleep in less than 5 minutes channel. Thank you very much. You don't actually have to stay here and watch this. I am trying my best in terms of being able to present a very sort of conducive point here. But a lot of people are criticizing Putin, saying that, he's just being boring. Well, if you're coming to this lecture, I'm sorry, but I'm going to be far more autistic than Putin was, and more autistic by design, because I'm going around and trying to dissect the points he's making. So if you found the original boring, then I'm going to be, by that definition, far more boring. I'm not going to refer to it as boring, but if you found the original documentary boring and it didn't inspire you in any way, I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for the fact that I'm being very autistic here, and I'm going to carry on regardless in excruciating detail. So here we go. In 1921, peace with Poland was proclaimed. And under the treaty, the right bank of the Dnieper once again was given to Poland. So, again, Putin is looking to this. It's actually very useful having this image on the left, because that is very much the image that Putin has in his brain in terms of conceiving of this unified Russian state. Obviously, you can see that map is not a unified Russian state, but that is the territory that Putin has in his mind when talking about concepts of statehood. That really is sort of the fundamental point to get over here, that whenever Putin is talking about the state, he means the map on the left. He doesn't mean, obviously, with regards to the right of the border, where it excludes Siberia, but he definitely means the European border, which pushes into as far as modern-day Poland and as far as Lithuania, the East Slavic conglomeration, so to speak. So when he's talking about peace with Poland, the treaty affording the territory to the right bank of the Dnieper was again given back to Poland. So he's talking about the Russian Empire having originally been able to restore the territory you see on the left. And then Poland has regained these territories. It's been a reversal of history. Putin, of course, forgets the fact, he omits the fact, that the broad section of Poland had been under Russian rule since 1815, since the end of the Napoleonic Wars. This territory was called Congress Poland, and it was centered around Warsaw. The Russians didn't control all of Poland. A large part of Poland, as I already mentioned, or old Poland, was controlled by the Austrians. Another part was controlled by the Prussians. But it's fair to say that if Putin is talking about the loss of territories within a failed attempt to restore quote-unquote Russian statehood or the Russian territory, he's ignoring the fact that the Russians had occupied Poland up until this point. So in many ways, you can say the Polish were justified if Putin is going to apply the same logic back here. But again, another thing Putin does, and it's something I talked about with great length, over on, I think it was Hitman's channel, where I discussed the duality of Russian civilization. When Putin talks about things like the Bolsheviks sought to restore the statehood, what he really means is that he's conflating the Bolsheviks with a, you can say, a Russian nation. And the Bolsheviks definitely didn't consider themselves, they never formally considered themselves as that. The Soviet Union was officially a universalist cosmopolitan state. And yet part of Putin's way of being able to reconcile the USSR as part of Russian history is to basically see the Bolsheviks not as an aberration, but as a continuity. And so he makes the erroneous claim here that the Bolsheviks sought to restore the territory of the Russians, and not the fact that the Bolsheviks only saw that as an incidental point. But that again is enough, another point that I need to sort of belabor here, which is Putin, his own conception of the Soviet Union and how that figures in to a 1,000-year view of Russian quote-unquote statehood. Back to Putin. In 1939, after Poland cooperated with Hitler, it did collaborate with Hitler, you know. Hitler offered Poland peace and a treaty of friendship and alliance. We have all the relative documents in the archives, demanding the return of Poland, demanding that Poland give back the so-called Danzig Corridor, which connected the bulk of Germany with East Prussia and Königsberg after World War I. This territory was transferred to Poland, and instead of Danzig, a city of Gdansk emerged. Hitler asked them to give it amicably, but they refused. Still, they collaborated with Hitler, engaged together in the partitioning of Czechoslovakia. Right, I'm just, yes, okay, here. This is the most contentious point that virtually everyone is bringing up regarding, you know, where Putin gets things factually wrong. What I've really been discussing here is that Putin hasn't been factually wrong, but he's made errors of conflation and omission, and he's removed a huge amount of nuance in order to present a very sort of consistent argument in terms of the indivisibility of a Russian territory and a Russian people, even though his conception isn't specifically ethnic, as I've gone into. So what he's doing with Poland it really is, I would say, irrelevant in terms of his broader point. So why is he bringing it up? I really think it's to conflate the idea that there is a general Western-backed conspiracy aimed at Russia, and thereby Poland collaborates with Hitler in order essentially to... like I said, it really does seem irrelevant in terms of his broader point, because the origins of World War II, what the relationship between Hitler and the nature of the promise over Danzig was, and the fact that the Poles took over an area in the Transsalza, which is part of Czechoslovakia, which was considered Polish majority in 1919. I was discussing with people on Twitter about this. Again, it's the term collaborate. Officially, in terms of the specific use of that word, there was collaboration. But you can say association is too weak of a word, and collaboration is too strong of a word, because collaboration has very significant pejorative implications, especially in terms of World War II, because collaboration indicates some form of supplicancy towards Germany and a general agreement with German aims. But what Putin is talking about here is a general sort of, you can say, there is an outright hostility between Poland and Germany. There are areas of mutual advantage. In terms of the relevant documents he's pointing to, Hitler promised Poland a peace and treaty of friendship alliance. Back in 1934, there was a German-Polish non-aggression pact. When the... Oh, for goodness sake, my brain is going. When the Japanese entered into a closer alignment along with the Italians or the Germans, the Japanese were actually the ones to continually point out that Poland should be brought into a general alliance with Italy, with Germany, and with Japan, because Japan had very good relations with Poland dating back to the era of Piłsudski, the founder of the Second Polish Republic, rotating around Promethean ideas about the disintegration of the Soviet Union and expanding Poland eastwards. So there are elements of this in which Poland offered a prospect of an anti-Bolshevik alliance. However, that's very much the angle that Putin is going for here. But that also implies that they had something of a working alliance, which amounts to a conspiracy in which the aggression was targeted at the Soviet Union as paramount, and that after Hitler basically gained what he wanted in the Danzig corridor, which the Polish obviously didn't give him, there may have been some anti-Soviet alliance of the Japanese, of the Italians, of the Poles, and of the Germans. At that point, we're really entering into the world of historical fiction. But like I said, it's not strictly a relevant point. And so one has to wonder why he's bringing it up. And the reason I think he's bringing it up is, as with my pre sort of anti-Comintern pact logic, he's talking about the encirclement of Russia, and in particular, the idea of Poland and its desire to dismember parts of the Russian state, or rather now the Soviet Union, which is in no way synonymous with a Russian state. And another point you can bring up here is that Poland had annexed Galicia Lodomeria, which had briefly at one point perhaps been considered the origin of Ukrainian statehood and could have been amalgamated into the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. But I'll continue on. I think that's enough in terms of indulging here. So Tucker Carlson goes on to say, may I ask, you are making the case that Ukraine, certain parts of Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, in fact, has been Russia for hundreds of years. Why wouldn't you just take it when you became president? And Putin obviously rebuffs him. You know, I'll tell you. I'm sorry if this thing is becoming boring. Again, obviously that's a feature which I hope isn't going to be a fact for most people listening to this very detailed breakdown. But here we are. So Putin then goes on to say, good, good. I'm so gratified that you appreciate that. Thank you. So before World War II, Poland collaborated with Hitler. And although it did not yield to Hitler's demands, it still proclaimed in the partitioning of Czechoslovakia together with Hitler. As the Poles had not given the Danzig corridor to Germany and went too far, pushing Hitler to start World War II by attacking them, why was it Poland against whom the world started on the first, the World War started on the 1st of September 1939? Poland turned out to be uncompromising, and Hitler had nothing to do but start implementing his plans with Poland. And I would try and read all of this in order to understand the entire perspective he's giving here. By the way, the USSR, I have read some archive documents, behaved very honestly. It asked Poland's permission to transit its troops through the Polish territory to help Czechoslovakia. But then foreign ministers said that if the Soviets flew planes over Poland, they would be downed over the territory of Poland. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that the war began and Poland fell prey to the policies it pursued against Czechoslovakia, as under the well-known Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, part of that territory, including Western Ukraine, was to be given to Russia. Thus, Russia, which was then named the USSR, regained its historical lands, again referring to this idea of Russian statehood, the indivisibility of these territories you see on the left. Now, that is, again, all technically true, but the problem is it's incredibly egregious in terms of its overall framing. So, what Putin is doing is focusing on the Munich Agreement. Because at the moment, you can say that Czechia is one of the breaches in terms of the NATO alliance, because the Czechs don't have a particularly favorable view of the West. And it stems back to in 1938, we have the Great Betrayal, whereby France and Britain sold out the Czechs to the Germans, and then the Germans annexed the Sudetenland. After that, the Germans, the Hungarians annexed southern Slovakia, and the Poles annexed part of Czechoslovakia as well. A few months later, the Germans invaded Czechoslovakia. Czechia now was occupied as part of the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, and Slovakia was created as a German client state. What Putin is doing is saying that the USSR had essentially a clean ledger, had a sort of moral desire to uphold the inviolability of the territory of Czechoslovakia, while all the other states were involved in tearing it apart. However, again, that point is not relevant to Ukraine. And what he's doing here is to basically say that the Poles were the authors of their own downfall by actively collaborating in the carving up of the territories which had been feasted on by the Germans. And then, of course, they themselves fell prey to the implications of their own collaboration by refusing to give over territory themselves. Now, that simply isn't true. And that's Putin's justification for how World War II began. And he glosses over the fact that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact had an integral aspect of that. Instead, to Putin, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was simply a process by which Russia restored territory in Western Ukraine and Belarusia. What he doesn't mention is the fact that if we're looking for quote-unquote collaboration, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was a far more obvious iteration of collaboration, an infamous iteration of collaboration. And the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was the impetus for Hitler invading Poland in September of 1939. Without the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, without the guarantee that the Soviets would not intervene to protect Poland, Hitler would not have attacked Poland. So what Putin's doing here is glossing over the fact that the Soviet Union very much collaborated, far worse in terms of divvying up territories. I mean, just to put this in perspective, Poland acquires a tiny amount of what was Czechoslovakia. As per the secret contingent of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the Soviet Union gained eastern Ukraine, it gained Belarusia, it gained Lithuania, and it would go on to invade Finland, and it would go on later after that, after the failure to annex Finland, but rather to regain territories around the Kurajja and north of Leningrad, to occupy the Baltic states. And Putin completely glosses over that, because in this sense, collaboration worked to the benefit of Russia and the Soviet Union, and Putin agrees with this. He talks about the restoration of quote-unquote historical lands. And again, in terms of his conflation of the Soviet Union and Russia, the Soviet Union isn't Russia. The Soviet Union, in many ways, was a state created to nullify the preeminence of Russia. In the 1920s, people talked about it as the great Russian chauvinism emanating out from the preponderance of Russians in the Soviet Union. And yet Putin is looking at the legacy of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, again, as with the partitions of Poland with Catherine the Great. It is a process of restoration, and is restoration in specifically nationalistic terms. And in that sense, it could be justified. So again, I would say out of all the things he said, by far the most dishonest. And what I find baffling about this, he could have just ignored all of this. He really could have and just skipped to Ukraine in World War II. Because of all the parts of his spiel on history, getting to his points, it does seem to be the most disingenuous, and obviously disingenuous to the point that the fucking virtue signaling historians are all going out there with their knives out. Anyway, after the victory in the Great Patriotic War, as we call World War II, all these territories were ultimately enshrined as belonging to Russia, to the USSR. Again, now he's conflating the USSR to Russia, is the point I've been making. As for Poland, it received apparently in compensation the lands which had originally been German, the eastern parts of Germany. Of course, Poland regained access to the Baltic Sea and Danzig, which was now given its Polish name. So this is how the situation was developed. In 1922, when the USSR was being established, the Bolsheviks started building the USSR and established the Soviet Ukraine, which had never existed before. So having established the idea of Polish-German collaboration, which did exist in a form of association for mutual advantage, but it did not exist to nearly the same extent that the Soviet-German collaboration existed. And you can say it wasn't a collaboration, it was really a formal alliance before 1941. He is then going on to talk about the restitution, or rather the compensation of territories at the expense of Germany, the process by which the old German territories of East Pomerania, southern East Prussia, and Silesia were awarded to Poland, and a process of ethnic cleansing of the Germans took place in those territories. Now, why Putin bring this up is because he refers to this as Stalin's gift. And in some way, you can say that the Russians, and before then the Soviet Union, thought of this as an equitable trade. In many ways it was. The territories that the Polish gained in the West were far more economically advantageous to hold than the provinces in the East. But that is a way, you can say, of justifying the fact that the Russians took the territories of the Second Polish Republic in the East, the fact that I've completely lost my train of thought. I'll continue from there. But like I said, he's trying to present Russia in terms of its relationship with Poland as equitable and generous. And again, you can say that this ultimately benefited Russia, awarding Poland so much territory, because Poland was under the occupation of the Red Army, and it expanded the frontiers of the Russian buffer state up to the River Oder, assuming East Germany might one day be reunited with West Germany. So again, Putin's talking about Polish aggression. He's talking about the compensation, Stalin's gift. And again, all of this is done to present Russia or the Soviet Union in the best possible light. So continuing on. In 1922, when the USSR was being established, the Bolsheviks started building the USSR and established the Soviet Ukraine, which had never existed before. Stalin insisted that those republics be included in the USSR as autonomous entities. For some inexplicable reason, Lenin, the founder of the Soviet state, insisted that they be allowed to withdraw from the USSR. And again, for some unknown reasons, he transferred that newly established Soviet Republic of Ukraine, some of the lands together with people living there, even though those lands had never been called Ukraine, and yet they were made part of the Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Those lands included the Black Sea region, which was received under Catherine the Great, which had no historical connection to Ukraine whatsoever. So it's actually probably instructive to look at this image on the right here. So Putin said a lot there. When he says that before 1922, a Soviet Ukraine had never existed before, he's technically correct, but that implies a Ukraine didn't exist before then. When the Russian Revolution broke out, I mean the original revolution, the February-March Revolution, the various sort of peripheral identities within the now Russian Republic essentially came to the central government in Petrograd through a form of alliance. And when the Bolshevik government took over, all of these national groupings in the Baltic states and in Ukraine and the Caucasus declared their independence. When the Germans were able to impose the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which ended World War I between Russia and Germany, onto the Soviet Union, all of a sudden you had all of these little states which had divested themselves from obedience to the new Bolshevik regime in Moscow. And one such state was Ukraine. There were many governments who claimed to represent the real government of Ukraine. There were Tsarists, there were Cossacks, there were Republicans, and there were, of course, communists. The Germans attempted to establish a, you can say, a royalist government in Ukraine, which was called the Ukrainian state, or the Hetmanate of Ukraine. The Hetman in this instance effectively being the equivalent of a Ukrainian king. So there were many iterations or attempts to create or start up a Ukrainian state between 1917 and 1922. And what distinguishes the Soviet Ukraine from all the others is that the Soviet Ukraine actually succeeded in this endeavor. So now we get on to the point that Putin is talking about the lands which were included in the Black Sea region, which were received under the Catherine the Great, had no historical connection with Ukraine whatsoever. And I'll come back and read from the BBC article, which again, it presents the poor argument before I try and actually steel man this. Mr. Putin claims that areas in the south and east of Ukraine had no historical connection with Ukraine whatsoever, conquered from the Ottoman Empire by the Russian Empress Catherine the Great in the 17th century. The Russian president says that that means that these lands are in fact rightfully Russian. Mr. Putin later refers to them using the 18th century term Novorossiya, New Russia. Mr. Suni, one of the BBC's pet academics, points out that the inhabitants of these lands, when they were conquered by Russia, were neither Russian nor Ukrainian, but Ottoman, Tatar, or Cossack Slav peasants who had fled the frontiers. By claiming that these territories are in reality Russian serves Mr. Putin's interests, as they are precisely the areas that Russia is attempting to conquer from Ukraine during the now decade-long conflict with its neighbor. The so-called Novorossiya includes Crimea, illegally annexed from Ukraine in 2014. New Russia also covers the regions around Kherson, Mariupol, Bakhmut, which Putin declared to be part of Russia in 2022. So the BBC is going about this and claiming that this is all simply a matter of politicking. This is to establish a legitimate claim over the regions which Russia has recently annexed. And by extension, they're claiming that Russia itself has no particular authority over them vis-a-vis Ukraine, because these were territories occupied by Tatars and non-Russians. Essentially, this territory represents the Pontic steppe for which the Ukraine was established in the first place, the frontier for which to oppose the Tatars. Now, the reason that the BBC argument is disingenuous here is because during the late 18th century and early 19th century, this area was subject to an aggressive program of colonization. Mention Mariupol, mention Kherson, mention also the city of Odessa. And this is also where the term Potemkin village comes from, representing, you can say, a sham in terms of creating sort of model colonies or little towns in order to impress the Austrian ambassador, etc. But the point is that the area was aggressively colonized. It wasn't just colonized by Russians. It was colonized by Greeks. It was colonized by Germans. The Greeks in particular had an enclave around Mariupol. And of course, it was also colonized by Cossacks and the precursors to Ukrainians, Little Russians. As a result, the region became, especially the region around in the east, around Donetsk and the Crimea, with the exception of the Tatars, had a very large Russian, Great Russian population. Indeed, the Russians had a lot of sort of a psychological effect in terms of investing themselves in Crimea in particular. Crimea to them was refashioned as Taurida. Taurida was an ancient Greek appellation, along with Khersonis and Odessos. And the idea here was that Novorossiya was going to be the gateway for the Russians' eventual conquest of Constantinople. psychologically, you can say that opening themselves up to the Black Sea was the, according to Catherine the Great and Potemkin, the restoration of Russia as an empire, appealing to the legacy of Byzantium by specifically relating all these cities, these new cities, back to the idea of the ancient Greek patronage, again, looking back to Russia's Orthodox pedigree and the desire, the dream of returning to Constantinople. But going beyond the conceptual ideas regarding the creation of Novorossiya, the fact is that ethnically, the region was very distinct from the core Ukraine. On this map is actually quite instructive. On the map on the right, which is before the annexation of the Crimean Khanate in 1774, when you see the purple Cossack state, and then you see the core left bank Ukraine around the city of Kiev, you can say the core of old Ukraine is that little region in the darker green, whereas the Cossack region was the area in purple. The region below that was the core project for the colonization program as part of Novorossiya. So what the BBC is essentially trying to do is that because before 1774, these regions were mostly Tatar, then ultimately it should belong to the Tatars. No, Putin is making a claim that Novorossiya has a very distinct history and relationship to that of Russia, which is not shared by the right bank Ukraine, the left bank Ukraine, Zaporizhia, the Wild Fields, and the Sitradas. It is a separate entity. And there is an aspect of arbitrariness, the fact that this region became integrated into Ukraine in the first place. And Putin is lost for words. He's saying, okay, why? You know, it seems inexplicable is the word he uses, or rather the translation of the word he uses. So it's not inexplicable. The reason I believe that the Ukrainian territory developed such, first of all, there were many Ukrainian projects coming out about establishing some sort of a ethnic projection from a Ukrainian state made by Drahamanov in the 1890s, which projected going as far as the using the Don as the natural boundary for Ukraine. But the annexation of Novorossiya and Crimea in particular was very useful for the Germans, who wanted to expand their control in Eastern Europe through to the Caucasus and to the oil fields in Baku and the wheat fields, which essentially dominated that region. So there was a strategic impetus for the Germans to link those territories together when dismembering these core territories from the Soviet Union, which had previously been the Russian Republic and the Russian Empire. Considering, I think that's a valid position to take as to why these territories existed the way they do, I'm find it baffling that Putin actually doesn't make that same insinuation, because I'm trying to steel man his arguments here, but there we are. There is also something else he brings up, which again is this conflation, wrong conflation in my view, between the USSR and Russia, because he says that for some inexplicable reason, the founder of the Soviet state insisted that the nations be allowed to withdraw from the USSR. The reason he insisted that the nations be able to withdraw from the USSR is because the USSR was not conceived of as a Russian empire. The USSR was conceived of as a collection of all of the prospect of Soviet states all across the world, workers' republics, effectively, workers' states. 1918, 1919 was supposed to be the year of the worldwide workers' revolution. So preventing a state from leaving the socialist project invariably meant that few states would ever want to opt into it. So there was an ideological reason as to why Lenin tried to conceive of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics as a union of equal republics, which is why he aggressively pursues this policy of kolonizatsiya, the idea that these nations are real nations. We will make Ukraine, Ukraine. We will make this territory into a cohesive national whole, and this will apply for all of the respective republics. There is an ideological impetus here. And maybe Putin, despite having been brought up in the Soviet Union, despite being a member of the KGB, maybe he's been disingenuous here. But I think in order to conflate his understanding of Russia as a continuity and not seeing the Soviet Union as that of a breach, he needs to conceive of this as representing a continuity of Russian statehood and Russian territory, hence going back to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and justifying it by saying, oh, this was the restoration of the historic lands of Russia. So going on, The Soviet Ukraine was given a great deal of territory that had never belonged to it, including the Black Sea region. At some point, when Russia received them as an outcome of the Russo-Turkish wars, they were called Novorossiya. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that Lenin, the founder of the Soviet state, established Ukraine that way. And again, I don't believe that. I believe what Lenin was presented with a fait accompli. Lenin was presented with a Ukraine which had more or less been established by the pre-socialist regimes that had been attempting to claim control over that region. You should also know that this region had not been allied with the Bolsheviks during the original revolution. It had been one of the hotspots for white activity and Cossack agitation against the Reds in the Russian Civil War. So it seems politic for Lenin, rather than getting involved and trying to alter the makeup of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, simply to confirm Russian control over Crimea, which is essential in terms of its strategic ability to project power out into the Black Sea, and leave the rest of Ukraine as is. Because so long as the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic is allied to the Soviet Union, an integral part of the Communist Party, then what does it matter if Novorossiya is part of Ukraine? So I won't say, as Putin does, that Lenin created it that way or established it that way. I would say Lenin left it that way. Anyway, I'll continue. For decades, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic developed as part of the USSR, and for unknown reasons again, the Bolsheviks were engaged in Ukrainianization. And again, they aren't unknown reasons. Like I said, Putin seems to not understand Soviet history. Ukrainianization was there in order to establish the Soviet Union as a truly cosmopolitan culture and not a Russian empire. I'm not going to make that point again because I've made it so many times here, but Putin is making the same mistake over and over again. It was not merely because the Soviet leadership was composed to a great extent of those originating from Ukraine. Rather, it was explained by the general policy of indigenization pursued by the Soviet Union. Same things were done in other republics. This involved promoting national languages and national cultures, which is not bad in principle, but this is how the Soviet Ukraine was created. Again, not bad in principle. So Putin, again, reinforcing the fact he doesn't have an ethnic conception of Russia. He believes that Russia can be a conglomeration of many peoples, many religions. However, it has to revolve around this idea of a Russian territory as having existed all the way back since the year 862. After World War II, Ukraine received, in addition to the lands that had belonged to Poland before the war, part of the lands that had previously belonged to Hungary and Romania, today what is now Western Ukraine. So Romania and Hungary had some of the lands taken away and given to Ukraine, but they still remain part of Ukraine. So in this sense, we have every reason to affirm that Ukraine is an artificial state that was shaped at Stalin's will. And that is the basis of Putin's entire claim. That is where everything has been leading to in terms of arriving at this point, that this was an artificial state that was established by Lenin and shaped by Stalin. If you look at this map is what Putin is referring to when he talks about a Ukrainian state established by Stalin's will. This is more or less in consistent, again, if you look at this, sorry. I have to get this up again. I think I've lost my PowerPoint. I think I'll just have to go it along like this now. Anyway, I've used my map enough. I think it would just justify me talking like this now. But those borders, according to Putin, are consistent with the historical trajectory of the old Rus peoples going far west. So what do we mean by an artificial state when Putin's talking about it? He refers to it as an artificial state because these are historically Russian territories as existing as one unified centralized state for millennia. And yet it is now being appropriated to this new Ukraine. And what is Ukraine? Well, in terms of being able to justify these territories as belonging to Ukraine, to again counter Putin's point here as to why there may be a justification for Ukrainian expansion, the areas annexed during World War II were Galicia, a territory that had been part of the Second Polish Republic and had been the genesis, essentially, of Ukrainian nationalism under the Austrian Empire. So, It therefore seems natural that from a Ukrainian nationalist perspective, these territories be taken over. Going far into Hungary, that territory, which is the Carpathian Rusin, Carpathian Ruthenia, which is the furthest part west of Ukraine, was part of Czechoslovakia in 1938. It was then annexed by Hungary. Hungary, by that way, had controlled that region for hundreds of years as part of their ancient patrimony of the lands of St. Stephen. But as a result of the rise of Hitler and the demise of Czechoslovakia, that territory became Hungarian again. And it was Hungarian up until the point that the Soviet Union occupied and conquered Hungary in 1945. So this region, which had a Rusyn population, which were Eastern Slavic, was justified as belonging to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. As for the areas he talks about, which in Romania, Bessarabia, southern Bessarabia, which was awarded to Ukraine, northern Bessarabia, by the way, was annexed by Stalin before World War II as part of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. He then lost it during Operation Barbarossa and it was given back to Romania. But then Bessarabia, both South and North Bessarabia, were then re-annexed by the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. Northern Bessarabia became the Moldovan Soviet Socialist Republic. And in the South, that little enclave in the South became part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, why Stalin did this is anyone's guess, but there was some justification for it, which is that region is one of the most ethnically diverse regions. I don't mean that in a modern sense, I mean that historical sense. There are Romanians, there are Ukrainians, there is a sort of small Turkish population, there are Hungarians, there are tons of little enclaves of populations living in that area. And so you can say if Ukraine is such a fundamental component in the management of the USSR, so for example, Khrushchev was a Ukrainian party boss. He would go on to succeed Stalin. His predecessor was Lazar Kaganovich, a right-hand man to Stalin and touted as a potential successor to Stalin. He was also Ukrainian, head of the Ukrainian party. There was a symbiotic relationship in the Soviet Union, which artificially inflated the importance of Ukraine within the makeup of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And so in terms of loyalty, you can say that it therefore makes sense in terms of divvying up these territories and awarding them to Ukraine, especially as a way of counteracting Ukrainian nationalists who were essentially appealing to Ukrainian independence and still fighting, by the way, in various guerrilla groups within parts of the Soviet Union during the war and after the war. So there is a justification as to why the borders should exist that way. In terms of defining it as an artificial state, I think what Putin really is getting at here is that there is perhaps a organic conservative conception of the evolution of states, whereby states arrive at their borders through a process of historical development, which is determined by themselves. So, for example, in France, France started off with effectively borders that excluded Brittany, excluded Provence, excluded what is now Lorraine. And through the course of much of the medieval and early modern period, France establishes its borders to the Mediterranean, to the Atlantic, to the English Channel, and it forms the quote-unquote Pentagon, expanding to the River Rhine and what is now the borders, well, then the borders of Flanders, but now the borders of Belgium. In other words, you can say France was able to determine the state of its own borders by its own volition. You can use that example for many other states. However, when it comes to Ukraine, I believe Putin's argument here is that Ukraine was established by a Russian, Lenin, which again is contentious, but that's his point. It was then buttressed and augmented with various territories by Stalin. In the same way, he will probably claim that there is an artificiality to Poland's modern borders, because Poland's borders were given as compensation for the losses in the East. In other words, the western borders of Poland are Stalin's gift. So Ukraine, as the borders of 1945 were determined, is the artificial Ukraine. It is Ukraine which has been determined by Russia. Russia as a core component of the Soviet Union. And again, Putin doesn't seem to understand that we're not talking about Russian overlordship in the imperial sense. We're talking about components of a union of Soviet socialist republics. So from the communist point of view, they would look at this as all of these independent republics collaborating together to be able to expand into these new borders, which they would consider to be a restoration in terms of this process of indigenization and forming nations within the Soviet Union. So within the theory of Marxism-Leninism, as it is applied within the concept of socialism in one country, there is an argument to say that Ukraine was a creation through a process of collaboration with other powers within the Soviet Union and was not simply a state whose borders were determined by another power or an authority on high, such as Stalin. I didn't expect to be taking such a strident position here. But again, I am doing my best in terms of being able to explain all the perspectives in which Putin's view can be seen as somewhat disingenuous here. So, yes, there is a justification for Ukraine as having its borders. It's not a perfect justification. There are vast numbers of ethnic Russians living in Ukraine. There are Moldovans living in Ukraine. There are Poles living in Ukraine. There are Hungarians living in Ukraine. In fact, Putin then goes on anecdotally to talk about the Hungarians in Ukraine who had retained their national identity and still spoke Hungarian. And all of these points, again, are to buttress the fact that Ukraine is multinational. But in the same way that he's allowed to offer Russia the benefit that Russia could be multinational, in the case of Ukraine, Putin is bringing up the plurality of nationalities as something artificial because they were forced into it by the contrivance of Stalin after World War II. So that is really all I have to say on the first part when it comes to arriving at the creation of a Ukrainian state. And just to say in summary that, again, Putin is conflating the USSR with Russia. He believes that Russia has defined borders going back to the Middle Ages. He believes, therefore, that Ukraine and Belarus must be considered, you can say, an extension of Russia within these borders. But Ukraine in and of itself as having these borders represents some form of artificial aberration because they did not arise naturally. And Ukrainian identity in and of itself is a process of alienating the Russian aspect of those people and becoming something else, which in itself was the creation of Poland and the creation of a conspiracy launched by Austria and then amounted to and built upon by the idea of the German occupation and the creation of the Reichskommissariat of Ukraine, as if to summarize Putin's argument of what he's at least trying to get into. Now, I can't go on and read the entire article for obvious reasons, but there are certain segments that I want to bring up. On Twitter, a lot of people were discussing, Academic Asian has this wonderful phrase, which I think is very apt here, talking about boomer truth. Boomer truth, in summary, is effectively a system of morals inherited from the good versus evil struggle in World War II. And Vladimir Putin accordingly buys into this notion of boomer truth by focusing Russia's identity around having defeated Hitler in the Second World War. Hence, we come to the issue of denazification. And Tucker Carlson asks, what is denazification? What would that mean? Vladimir Putin says, that is what I want to talk about right now. It's a very important issue. Denazification. After gaining independence, Ukraine began to search, as some Western analysts say, its identity. And it came up with nothing better than to build this identity upon some false heroes who collaborated with Hitler. I have already said that in the 19th century, when theorists of independence and sovereignty of Ukraine appeared, they assumed that an independent Ukraine should have very good relations with Russia. But due to the historical development, these territories were part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Poland, where Ukrainians were persecuted and treated quite brutally, as well as were subject to cruel behavior. There were also attempts to destroy their identity. All this remained in memory of the people. When World War II broke out, part of this extremely nationalist elite collaborated with Hitler, believing he would bring them freedom. the German troops, even the SS troops, made Hitler's collaborators do the dirtiest work of exterminating the Polish and Jewish populations, hence this brutal massacre of the Polish and Jewish populations, as well as the Russian population too. This was led by persons who are well known, Bandera and Shutkevich. It was these people who were made national heroes. That is the problem. And we are constantly told that nationalism and neo-Nazism exist in other countries as well. Yet these are seedlings, but we uproot them. And other countries fight against them. But Ukraine is not the case. These people have been made into national heroes in Ukraine. Monuments to these people have been erected. They are displayed on national flags. Their names are shouted by crowds that walk with torches, as it was in Nazi Germany. These were people who exterminated Poles, Jews, and Russians. It is necessary to stop this practice and prevent the dissemination of this concept. I say that Ukrainians are part of one Russian people. They say, no, we are part of a separate people. Okay, fine. If they consider themselves a separate people, they have a right to do so, but not on the basis of Nazism, the Nazi ideology. And just to compound this, okay, so my real question is, Tucker, what are you going to do about it? I mean, Hitler has been dead for 80 years. Nazi Germany no longer exists. And it's true. So I think that what you're saying, you would want to extinguish or at least control part of Ukrainian nationalism. How would you do that? This question appears to be subtle. It's quite pesky. Yes, say Hitler has been dead for 80 years, but his example lives on. People who exterminated Jews, Russians, and Poles are alive, and the president, the current president of today's Ukraine, applauds him in the Ukrainian parliament, giving him a standing ovation. Can we say that we have completely uprooted this ideology? If what we see is happening today, that is what denazification is in our understanding. We have to get rid of these people who maintain this concept and support this practice and try to preserve it. That is what denazification means. That is what we mean. Okay. A lot to break down here. So Putin refers to the theorist in the 19th century who assumed that Ukraine would have good relations with Russia. As I explained earlier, there is a lot of nuance with that, and Putin is willingly conflating Ukrainian theorists with Little Russian theorists and Pan-Slavists and Cossack fetishists, for lack of a better word, people working in the orbit of the Horodnas, the Narodniks, all of these popular associations focusing on an alternative system of government to the Tsardom and focusing on identity, which romanticizes the lifestyle of the steppe. All of these groups obviously have very sort of disparate aims. Some of them, like I said, ideologically are committed to Russian unity through the idea of Pan-Slavism. But this idea in many ways is democratic, and so you can say antithetical to the idea of the preservation of an autocracy as exhibited within the Russian Empire. But Ukrainian identity, as separate from that, is actually quite hostile to the identification of Little Russia. Because to be Little Russian, again, Putin actually doesn't bring this term up or any of these nuances. There is simply Russian and Ukraine. There aren't Little Russians. There aren't Ruthenians. There are simply Russians and Ukrainians. And I think he does so, and effectively he's presented with a fait accompli. Ukrainians now self-identify as Ukrainians. And so what he's going to do about it, is he going to insist that they begin to call themselves Little Russians? No, I think he thinks that's a lost cause. So instead, he conflates all of these words together with Ukrainian as to take all of this intellectual background, this heritage regarding all of these ideas, this intellectual furnace in the 19th century. And building upon this, he is trying to conflate all these theorists of having some attempt to reconcile both Ukrainian and Russian nationality. As I said, that's not the case. And Ukrainian nationality seems to be predicated on hostility to all of these other forms of association with Russia. And like I said, there was a legitimate concern of Russia being attacked through Austria using the Ukrainian casus belli to annex territories from Russia, using Ukraine as a pretext. Like I said, it's not the way that Putin's presenting it, but he's presenting it for an obvious reason, as if to bring the Ukrainians back into the fold and said, you are part of the patrimony of Russia. But what does he mean when he says you are allowed to be a separate people, but you're not allowed to do so based on Nazi ideology? So I continue here. So he talks about the persecution under the Poles. Again, the process of othering, the process of foreign subjugation. Again, he doesn't mention the fact that, you know, the Russians did the same to many little Russians and Ukrainians. He doesn't mention the fact that Russia brutally put down a rebellion of the Poles in 1863. But again, all of this would simply complicate his point. So he comes finally to World War II. He talks about the SS. He talks about collaborators. And again, to buttress his point that naturally the Ukrainians and the Russians are supposed to have good relations, he focuses on the attacks made against the Poles and the Jews before he talks about the attacks on the Russians, as if it was effectively incidental. And also, he has completely divorced this from an ideological component. In many ways, he basically sees this as ethnic. He sees this as Ukrainians being stirred up by the Germans to attack other nationalities. He doesn't see that there is an ideological component to Nazism, which is predicated on the defeat of Marxism-Leninism as exhibited through Bolshevism. And so by Nazism, he is taking it as to mean an attack on Russia, an attack on the Russian people, a attempt to break up this fraternity of nations, Belarusia, Little Russia, or now Ukraine with Great Russia. And so something else I brought on Twitter in terms of being able to understand Nazification and denazification vis-a-vis the West. In the West, the term Nazi is used so often as if to become meaningless, but if it has any sort of pejorative association, the association has been broadened to encompass nearly all forms of nationalism. In Russia, the point I make is the opposite. Nazism has become synonymous with anti-Russian nationhood. In other words, to be a Nazi means that you are desirous to destroy not only the Russian state, but you desire to break up the, you can say, natural friendship between the Russian peoples, which would, according to Putin, include the Ukraine and the Belarusians. So to say that Putin is simply a iteration of Western boomer truth is not true at all. Rather, he looks at Nazism as both an existential threat to Russia, but a core component in as to why Ukraine would want to tear themselves apart from collaboration with Russia, and they would want to form an alliance with the West. And he brings up the examples of Bandera and Shushkevich. And the Bandera example is quite interesting because he did collaborate with the Germans. In fact, the Germans didn't really want his collaboration. He offered it and the Germans frankly refused it. He was involved in attacks against Poles and Jews, and he continued on attempting to incite a guerrilla campaign. He himself went into exile and he was assassinated by a KGB agent in 1959. But when Putin says that these people are venerated as heroes, he is correct. In 2010, the then president of Ukraine awarded him the posthumous title of the Hero of Ukraine. So what Putin is saying is effectively correct. He's looking at, say, for example, the example of Stepan Bandera and the Banderites, the organization of the Ukrainian nationalists, which had wanted to form a common front with the Germans, who are more focused on forming a German-led Reichskommissariat of Ukraine. And they are taking that as their cue to form an anti-Russian nationalism. However, again, all of this is predicated upon Putin's understanding that the Soviet Union and Russia are part of the same continuity. So he looks at the ethnic composition of the Soviet Union as Germany acting as the icebreaker, coming in and breaking up the inherent unity between all of these peoples. But he won't consider that many of the Banderites were ideologically opposed, and many of the people who collaborated with Germany were ideologically opposed to the Marxist-Leninist project. But in terms of a strictly nationalist conception, which removes those sort of ideological intricacies, Putin has boiling this down to its fundamental element, which is Nazi effectively means antithetical to the unity of the Russian peoples and desirous of the creation of Lebensraum, European expansion and subjugation of the Russian peoples. So there's a very specific connotation for neo-Nazi here. And it extends also to his use of Shushkevich here. Again, a man who was implicated in the Galicia-Volynesia massacres. So Putin is using his examples very effectively in terms of being able to associate Ukrainian nationalism with the cause of neo-Nazism. And by extension, he's extrapolating that to mean, if I'm going to try and understand why he's so serious and determined to neo-Nazify Ukraine, yes, there are the extreme examples he's talking about, but the logical consequence of what it really means for him to denazify Ukraine would be to remove a anti-Russian component to Ukrainian politics. In other words, you're allowed a separate identity, but it must be a separate identity running in parallel with Russia, not in opposition to it. Because the moment you enter into opposition with it, and moreover, the more you form collaborations with Western powers, in particular Germany, then you are now become associated in Putin's mind with Nazism. So it's a very broad umbrella grouping of all of these people, which, say, for example, you take the Azov Battalion, who are real neo-Nazis, then you project this to include virtually all of the most vehement groups fighting against Putin. And despite the fact that Putin recognizes that the president of Ukraine is himself a Jew. So there are many contradictions within this theory. But I think if you're trying to understand the essence of what Putin means by denazification, this is what he means. He has an indelible understanding of Russian statehood with a prescribed territory, a territory which he sees as indissoluble. You're allowed a conception of an identity which isn't based on ethnicity, but it must be in accordance in terms of loyalty to the motherland. And I think that, by way of a summary, we finally come to the final thing I want to talk about, which is Putin and his view of Russian orthodoxy, moving beyond the point of denazification. Tucker Carlson, you have described the connection between Russia and Ukraine. You have described Russia itself a couple of times as orthodox. This is central to your understanding of Russia. What does that mean for you? You are a Christian leader by your own description. So what does that what effect does that have on you? You know, as I already mentioned in 988, Prince Vladimir himself was baptized following the example of his grandmother, Princess Olga. And then he baptized his squad. And then gradually, over the course of several years, he baptized all the Rus. It was a lengthy process. From pagans to Christians, it took many years. But in the end, this orthodoxy, Eastern Christianity, deeply rooted itself in the consciousness of the Russian people. When Russia expanded and absorbed other nations who professed Islam, Buddhism, and Judaism, Russia has always been very loyal to these people who profess other religions. This is her strength. This is absolutely clear. And the fact is that the main postulates, main values are very similar, not to say the same, in all world religions I just mentioned, and which are the traditional religions of the Russian Federation, Russia. By the way, Russian authorities were always very careful about the culture and religions of the people who came into the Russian Empire. This, in my opinion, forms the basis of both the security and stability of the Russian statehood. All the peoples inhabiting Russia basically consider it their motherland. If, say, people move over to you or to Europe from Latin America, an even clearer and more understandable example, people come, but yet have come to you or European countries from their historical homeland, and people who profess different religions in Russia consider Russia their motherland. They have no other motherland. We are together. This is one big family, and our traditional values are very similar. I've just mentioned one big family, but everyone has his or her family, and this is the basis of our society. And if we say that motherland and the family are specifically connected with each other, it is indeed the case, since it is impossible to ensure a normal future for our children and our families unless we ensure a normal, sustainable future for the entire country, for the motherland. That is why patriotic sentiment is so strong in Russia. So, yes, you can look at this superficially and say diversity is our strength. But what distinguishes this conception of diversity is our strength from importing infinity immigrants in the West is that these people have belonged to a Russian empire or a Russian state for hundreds of years. You can say they have been culturally assimilated into a project of Russian civilization. and that is where their national loyalties lie. Yes, the Russian Federation is a mess of dozens of local sort of communities and groups, ranging from Mongols to Ugric peoples to Karelians, you know, etc. I don't need to list all of them to get my point. But Russia, as it exists, is incredibly linguistically, ethnically, and religiously diverse. And so by necessity, Putin cannot rely on a nationality which is built around ethnicity. Not only because it would cause issues within Russia, because it would complicate also his attempt to woo over the Ukrainians by appealing to a historic link, historic loyalty. This is why history is so important in terms of understanding this interview, because this is the crux of Putin's point. His appeal to loyalty is through history. It is not through ideology. It is not through ethnicity. We have a shared link. We have been bound together for hundreds of years. We are a motherland. We are the association of all these families together as Russia. We are a civilization. And by extension, if you extend this into the geopolitical realm, we can therefore better hold off the expansion of NATO. So there is a strategic impetus there, and there is a particular conception of what it means to be Russian. And Putin couldn't really have it anywhere else. Like I said, the minute he begins to promote Russian supremacy within the Russian Federation, all of a sudden you create all of these hotspots, all of these places for potential color revolution, where, say, for example, you can create a attempt of a secessionist movement in Siberia. This had already, say, for example, existed in Chechnya during the 1990s. So Putin comes to power off the back of this ethnic conflict. He is taking that as a cue and understands that the best way to create some sort of patriotic feeling is through a broader conception of history, uniting history together. And that is why I also believe he cannot disassociate Russia from the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union has to exist within the continuity of Russian statehood in order to represent the union of all these peoples. The Soviet Union, to an extent, represented the patrimony of the Russian Empire that came before it. And so you can't simply disabuse Russia of all of the history and indeed the successes that came out of the Soviet Union. Under the Soviet Union, Russia, as the main component of that, was a great power. Russia also defeated the quote-unquote Nazis. And if you're divorcing denazification from any ideological commitment to upset Marxism-Leninism, then denazification takes on a route of destroying the unity of peoples established by Russian history, founded on a historical fraternity, essentially. So understanding all this, it's very clear as to what Putin was trying to do here. History is the essence of his argument. It is the bedrock of his understanding of a Western betrayal, why he's so focused on vilifying the historical legacy of, say, for example, Polonization and Nazism, because he looks at things historically and he wants to return these nations to a state of friendly relations, ostensibly. Of course, you can say that this is entirely cynical, but I don't necessarily believe that. I don't think a person invests themselves so much in their history in terms of creating some sort of civilizational understanding of the nation upon which you rule purely through cynicism. There has to be some sort of greater ideological venerational commitment that runs throughout all of this. And the last thing I can say really to say is that obviously Putin, by design, when reading the segment out in terms of the careful and reciprocal relations and the loyalties owed, if you take this and put this in the example of the Soviet Union, this is just horrible. This is, it's a humiliation to people, say, for example, like the Tatars or the Volga Germans or any of the other ethnic groups that were forcefully relocated under Stalin. And so the only way that Putin can get around this great sort of ethnic upheaval and how appallingly some of the minorities were treated during the time of the Soviet Union, particularly the time of Stalin, is by simply saying, putting your head in the sand and saying, oh, Stalin was just another czar, and we have to ignore these policies as an aberration. And we have to look to the example of the Russian Empire and say that, say, for example, in the 19th century, especially during the Great Game, the Russians had to cultivate very good relations with the Cossacks, and they had to cultivate good relations with the myriad of Central Asian and Islamic peoples existing in essentially what is now the stans, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, etc., Uzbekistan, you get my point. Russia was able to win over a lot of those people as well as conquer them. The same exists in the Caucasus, but that's one side of the story. The other side, and the Circassians obviously were horrifically treated by the Russians in the 1860s. All of these things would complicate the view of how the Russians treated their minorities. But of course, Putin has to understand this view within a conception of a civilization historical fraternity. And that's where I'm going to end this conversation. Right, going on to the super chats. Jose Fernando Barral Dominguez, I'm Spanish is just sort of beyond my ability to pronounce, I'm afraid, sorry, for €5. I'll watch the rest of the stream tomorrow. Recently finished the AON series. Thank you for endless hours of content as I continue my history degree. The AON series, chat, am I missing something? Am I completely sort of missing something? Have I done an AON series? Does he mean autocracy, orthodoxy, and nationality, but it's just done around the wrong way? Okay, I'll assume that's what it is. Machiavelli sucks to go for $5. Thank you very much. AM, I was bragging about you to a woman who writes books today. Well, thank you very much, Machiavelli sucks to go. All right. I will have to thank all the people who are here. When I decided to do this stream an hour ago, off the cuff, I wasn't expecting over 900 of you to show up at any one time. I think this might be my largest viewed stream live by a considerable margin. So yes, that's where I'm going to leave it. It was like I said, a very impromptu stream, and I wanted this to serve as an example of how you do it, hopefully, how you deconstruct the claims made by certain politicians advancing a certain agenda, as opposed to simply putting your hands up and saying, oh, it's just nonsense. Oh, you know, Putin's evil. Putin's just trying to invade, you know, justify wars of conquest. It's far more subtle and interesting than that. And obviously, because the structure of this has been about going through and dissecting his points point by point, it's going to look as if it is rather hostile. Well, that's the nature of a critique. But I will point out what I find very depressing going through all this and going through this interview. I'm not going through a book. I'm going through an interview. Is that Putin displays an understanding and veneration of his own nation's history, which is, I would say, completely absent anywhere in the West. I mean, if you ask Rishi Sunak, for example, to do this, you know, probably instinctively, he wouldn't even start with England. He'd probably start his national history with Chandragupta. In the same way that, perhaps the French could do it out of all of them, but, you know, ask Olaf Scholz. The Germans seem apologetic of everything that came before 1945. So it is remarkable, and I would say somewhat encouraging, that anyone in power can actually have such a considerable grasp of the context in which they are operating, even if it has led, in the case of Putin. Again, I do believe this is Putin not being stupid. I do believe this is Putin being disingenuous, because he has to advance a particular agenda. And this is all part of a philosophical and historic understanding of what the relations between Ukraine and Russia need to be. And this is what he clearly established here. But obviously, when it comes down to it, this has a strategic design to it. It is not history in the sense that it is the pure pursuit of truth without agenda or adulteration in any way. Anyway. Just one last super chat that came through. Sam 153 for $5 Canadian. He just says, greatly enjoyed the stream. Well, thank you very much. All right. Good night, everyone.